You're listening to Laugh Tracks, a show about comedy and the Generation Exploitation Podcast. Here's a song from Bill Cosby.
All right, is this a take or what? All right, okay, everybody. Here we go. Here we go. Yeah, that's right. All that's good.
It was 20 years ago today that Sergeant Pepper taught the band to play. And they've been going in and out of style, but they're guaranteed to raise a smile. So may I introduce to you the act you've known for all these years, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Oh!
Sing it, children.
We're Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Sit back and let the evening go.
Boys.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
You might like to know that the singer's gonna sing a song, and he wants you all to sing along. So let me introduce to you the one and only Billy Shears and Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yes, that's Bill Cosby off his album Hooray for the Salvation Army Band. Of course, Sergeant Pepper. Bill Cosby singing, and we have a great show for you today on Laugh Tracks, a show about comedy, the Generation Exploitation Podcast. A big treat in the last half hour of the show today. We're going to listen to a very rare interview from 1979 from The Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder. Tom Snyder interviewing Michael Palin, Graham Chapman, and Terry Jones from Monty Python's Flying Circus. And this interview took place just around the time that the movie Life of Brian premiered. And the three of them talk about the difficulty of making fun of religion in a very, very religious type society like the United States is today, even more so today than it was in 1979. But a fascinating interview we're going to listen to. Right now, though, I thought we'd listen to some stuff that wasn't meant to be funny but actually is. We're going to listen to a track off a record right now put out by acclaimed actor Sidney Poitier, Journeys Inside the Mind.
If there was a knowledge which was able to make men immortal without giving them knowledge of the way to use that immortality, there would be no use in it. The best man is he who most tries to perfect himself. And the happiest man is he who most feels that he is perfecting himself. To a man who has any sense at all, no question can be more serious than the meaning of human life. Curious about that which is not one's concern, while still in ignorance of oneself, is ridiculous. Wealth and poverty are both evils. The one is parent of luxury and indolence, the other of meanness and viciousness. and both of discontent. When he who asks waits to hear the answer, he demonstrates a very rare gift. I have one singularly good quality, which is my salvation. I am not ashamed to learn. I ask and inquire and am indeed grateful to those who answer me. Happy nature will hardly feel the pressure of age, but to the opposite disposition, youth and age alike are equally a burden. The mask which an actor wears is apt to become his face. The unexamined life is not worth living. Like a good-for-nothing cock, without having won the victory, some people walk away from an argument and crow. Know thyself and nothing too much. My friends, if the soul is really immortal, what care should be taken of her, not only in respect of the portion of time which is called life, but of eternity?
Call the roll, call the roll, call the roll, call the roll, call the roll of the Justice League of America.
Superman!
Here!
Aquaman!
Here!
Wonder Woman!
Here!
Flash!
Here!
Metamorpho!
Here!
Plastic Man!
Here!
And Batman!
Here!
Yeah, here they come! Hey, look out, chum! It's the Justice League! The Justice League!
Superheroes all always on the ball! It's the Justice League!
The Justice League!
Takes big trouble with a capital B! A super colossal calamity! A tremendous, stupendous catastrophe! To bring them all out swinging! And when they're swinging, man, they're bringing big trouble with a capital T for any souped-up super enemy on Earth or in space or land or sea. Hey, do they put on a show anywhere the four winds blow?
When they get the call, watch them go. The Justice League, yeah, the Justice League. Oh, the Justice League.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our regular program to bring you a special broadcast direct from the secret sanctuary of the Justice League of America. Addressing the council at this emergency meeting is Superman.
Fellow members of the Justice League, the world is under attack at this very moment by the most powerful forces man has ever seen. Creatures from space, monsters from the depths of the earth, and criminals operating right within our cities. And they must be destroyed before they destroy the world. Operation Lifesaver is in effect as of right now.
Are you ready?
Yeah!
Are you with it?
Yeah!
Okay, let's go. You know what to do. The whole world's watching and counting on you. And all you people listening out there, everybody, everywhere.
Hang on! Hang on! Hang on!
The Justice League is coming.
Here
here we come. Hey, look out, chum, it's the Justice League.
The Justice League.
Superheroes all always on the ball. It's the Justice League.
The Justice League.
There's big trouble with the capital B. A super colossal calamity. A tremendous, stupendous catastrophe. And here we come out swinging. And when we're swinging, man, we're ringing. Show anywhere the four winds blow.
When we get the call, watch us go. The Justice League, yeah, the Justice League. Oh, the Justice League, that's the Justice League.
Good morning. This is the Xeroid Corporation of Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hello, Herb Tarlick here, General Sales Manager of WKRP in Cincinnati.
Hello, Herb.
I'm going to ask if your company would like to advertise on our station.
No, thank you, Herb.
Perhaps I could call back next week.
Yes, Herb, please do that. This has been a computerized transmission.
Okay, fine.
Jesus loves me so, and took away my sin. So he turns around and runs away. I wish he'd go away to stay. When Mr. Satan knocks at my heart's door, I just say no, no, no.
That was Little Marcy, a Christian ventriloquist dummy, of which there are many. She is the most famous of the Christian ventriloquist dolls out there on vinyl. We heard her singing When Mr. Satan Knocks on My Heart's Door from her LP, Marcy Sings to Children, on Syncord Records. Before that, we heard Herb Tarlick and some WKRP in Cincinnati robot-type sounds. Before him, we were listening to Songs and Stories about the Justice League of America. And at the start of that lo-fi composition, we heard the superheroes shouting, call the roll, call the roll. And if you didn't notice, you can play this back. The voice of Wonder Woman yelling, here! Obviously a man shouting in a poor falsetto, his attempt at sounding feminine. The Justice League of America song. Before that, we started with Sidney Poitier, Oscar award-winning actor Sidney Poitier. A record he put out on the Warner Brothers label, Journeys Inside the Mind, Poitier reading the dialogues of Plato to the jazz music of Fred Katz. And Fred Katz was actually a pseudonym for famed jazz musician Chico Hamilton, who also did the jazz music backing up the spoken word jazz LPs of Ken Nordine. I think we'll continue on this theme of playing records that were never intended to be amusing or funny when they were recorded, but actually are. We're going to listen to a record right now called Evel Knievel from 1974 by a daredevil you may have heard of who was very popular in the 1970s, a man named Evel Knievel. Yes, Robert Craig Knievel put out an LP to promote himself, and he put out just about anything to promote himself, from pajamas to bed sheets to toys and magazines and all sorts of things. Well, he put out this record. We're going to listen to three different parts of this album. First, we're going to listen to a really ridiculous, over-the-top introduction about how great Evel Knievel is. Then, we're going to hear a song about Evel Knievel. Then, we're going to hear poetry written by and performed by Evel Knievel.
There's a sea of people, perhaps 200,000 of them. They're gathered along the jagged edge of an awesome chasm. It's close to a mile wide and almost as deep. In the center of it all is a man, dressed in white leather and strapped into a rocket-like machine that is poised on its launching ramp. A gleaming red, white, and blue missile aimed at the other side. A tap on the helmet. Someone mumbles, "Good luck." The machine is detonated, and he's on his way. Science fiction? No. Because Evel Knievel, the most famous daredevil in the world today, is actually going to jump Idaho's incredible Snake River Canyon on his sky cycle. Why? We might just as well ask why Columbus sailed off to what everyone at the time thought was certain doom. Why Charles Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic in a single-engine plane. Why the astronauts shot for the moon. Each of them, like Knievel, possessed or was possessed by the desire and the ability to do something no one else had ever done before. Unlike a fighter or racer who competes to win against another fighter or racer, Knievel has only one ever-present competitor, death. I'd like to introduce to you, ladies and gentlemen, Evel Knievel.
Never thinking about tomorrow. His body shows the scars. Distraught, riding on the edge of danger, fears that God had. He can move a mountain, leap across a winding river. There's nothing he won't try. There's something deep inside him, lusting for the thrills that drive him. Yet he knows someday he's gonna have to face that canyon in the sky. A man in white stands ready. He feels their eyes upon him as he primes himself to go. He thunders towards the sky with the surge of steel beneath him. He'll challenge death to please the crowd below.
Well, a lot of people, they'd say, why do you do it? What's the matter with you? Why do you keep on doing it? And I, you know, I'd say, well, you know, money's good or this, that, or I didn't know how to answer them, really. I got so tired of getting asked why, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was on my way back to Los Angeles to perform for a man named Al Dobrich, who had the Dobrich International Circus at the time, and I was trying to get stronger so I could perform for him. And I remember when I was coming back across Texas, I think it was, and I had what they call an Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser station wagon. It had a glass top. And I was really delirious, almost to a point that my temperature was so high, and I was laying in the back of it, and I was looking out through this glass top, and I got to thinking about the question why that people asked me. And I said to Ray, I said, give me a notepad. Well, I was concerning writing a song, but I couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, so I wrote this poem, and I wrote it in a matter of an hour or 2 hours, just before it got daylight, it was done. And I think that it answers the question for every man and woman on the face of this earth at the end of it, why you do what you do and why I do what I do in life. And it's a very simple thing. And the poem goes like this, I'll do it for you. It seems that everywhere in this world I go, no matter who or what I know,
The people, they look. And most of them stare. And I wonder if they really care. You see this king with his golden crown? Some of them smile, but most of them frown. I hear them laugh, and I see them cry. No matter what, they all ask why. Why? Well, I'm just like you, and you, and you, and your wife. We all have a special purpose in life. And my way of life, I'm glad that I found, for like you, I too make the world go round. We're all alike. Oh, yes, we are. We all have a dream on some faraway star. For me, when it's over and done, at the end of a day, my men go to relax, but I go to pray. For I know that tomorrow, in some other place, I'll have that jump again to face. Each time I was hurt, they all said, that guy is lucky that he's not dead. And they were right. But I wanted to get up, to try it again. I kept telling myself that I knew I could win. So I'd close my eyes, and to the Lord I would pray. Oh, help me, God. Let me walk someday. And he did. Every stitch on every scar has just brought me closer to my dream afar. To be a man and to do my best, to stand alone is my only quest. Success is a term that has broad use. For you and I to have none in life, there's no excuse. For you to do what I do is not right. But for me, it's not wrong. What I've been trying to tell you all along is that it's got to be. So, if you wonder why, the answer to that is that just like you, I've got to be me.
Listening to the Generation Exploitation Podcast on the Internet and Laugh Tracks, a show about comedy on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. My name's Cliff Nesteroff, and we're here live every Thursday night, 11 p.m. to midnight Pacific Standard Time. music from J.J. Johnson there off the soundtrack of the excellent 1970 cop action film soundtrack to Across 110th Street on United Artists Records. That film starred Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto. Bobby Womack sang the theme song and J.J. Johnson doing the underscore music that we just heard there. So before that, we heard an array of awful goodies from Evel Knievel, Daredevil Extraordinaire, and his heartfelt dreck of a poem, Why, When the Jump is So High, Evel, Why? And the song about him prior to the poem mentioned that he might one day go to that great big canyon in the sky. I don't know if you caught that lyric in that song. Well, this record was released in 1974 as a piece of cross promotion for an upcoming stunt Evel Knievel was planning, the jump over Snake River Canyon in Montana. It was a jump that had been in the works for 3 years with promotion, training, and hype. And let's just say Evel didn't exactly make it across Snake River Canyon. To the contrary, in fact, it was his most resounding defeat. He broke most of his bones, barely made it halfway across, barely made it out alive. And all of these records that were released to promote that jump became a rather sad, ill-profited collectible and somewhat of a joke. So there you go, Evel Knievel. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as promised earlier, we're going to play a very rare interview from 1979, an episode of The Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder. An interview with Michael Palin, Graham Chapman, and Terry Jones talking about Life of Brian. The movie had just been released that week, and they talk about how difficult it is sometimes to make fun of religion, particularly Christianity, in a country like the United States and even England.
Correction, Muggable Mary is a woman, so that it'll save a lot of calls. Here's Mr. Michael Palin, who is best known to many of us from his hosting chores of Saturday Night Live. He is the very effeminate Pontius Pilate in Monty Python's Life of Brian. Joining him is Mr. Graham Chapman, who has the lead in the film, the role of Brian, and Mr. Terry Jones, who directed The Life of Brian and plays the role of Brian's mother, Mandy. Where did this whole thing start? I mean, you guys are wild and crazed. You were on the television series. Yes. But this thing is crazed, if you don't mind my saying so.
Well, now, it's very difficult. None of us can actually quite remember where it began, the idea for The Life of Brian. But I think it was when we were out promoting The Holy Grail.
The Grail,
We sat around in sort of deserted hotel lobbies late at night, trying to scrounge a brandy off night porters, and got to talking about what we might do next and whether to do another costume movie or whatever, and the idea of doing something in biblical times, because the sort of biblical film is such a stock convention, came up, and people liked the idea, and we then just started to approach it by just writing material, seeing if it worked, seeing if it fitted in. A lot of it didn't.
Would you describe the opening scene? Maybe you can almost do it. to give this audience some idea of the spoof that starts right from the very first scene when the three astrologers knee wise men.
Yes, it is our crudest bit, actually.
It's much better in the cinema. I don't think you should give it away, Terry.
No, I don't think so, no.
Terry has to wear certain clothes.
I never liked that opening scene particularly, I must say.
I think it's brilliant.
I thought, actually, you wrote it, isn't it? I mean,
Terry
I thought it was a bit over the top. So.
The opening scene of the film is where the three wise men come to the manger. And you expect that they would be coming to see the infant Jesus, and they bring frankincense and myrrh and gold. And they go in and they ask the woman inside what the name of the child is, and the woman says, well, his name is Brian. And then they do a prayer to Brian, and they leave the gifts and they go out. Then they come back in and take the gifts away from the woman who is in the manger, because they found the real manger with the infant Jesus right across the street.
That's
now, that's...
Just giving it all away.
That's just how it happens in the film. That's about a very good seat.
Well, the reason I wanted to have the story told was that will give the people who have not yet seen this picture some idea of the irreverence, which in the minds of some people borders on sacrilege, that appears in the film.
Yeah.
Now, when you were putting this together, were you anticipating the challenge to what you will call satire or lampooning that would come from religious organizations?
Yeah, I think we expected to get quite a lot of reaction from religious organizations. Well, not from religious organizations, but we thought there would be a comeback from people.
Yeah.
But I think it's quite interesting the way, I mean, we were very surprised, for instance, when it was the first people to complain were the Jewish organizations. That was a big surprise to us. It had never occurred to us in a million years that the stoning sequence was offensive to
I
Jews.
Think the trouble is that you just, when you're writing it, you can't see the film from everybody's point of view. I mean, we wrote We wrote it, I mean, basically as a comedy film, mm-hmm. and it just reflects all our six different ways of thinking about this particular period, and basically it's to make people laugh. And then reading this criticism from the various religious groups, you read into it and you suddenly find that the way they've seen it is something quite different to the way you'd intended. And I mean, that's just something you can never allow for when you're writing.
Did you set out to get the Bible? To really stick the Bible?
Got it, haven't you, Graham?
Not with me, no.
No.
I don't think we did. Not to get the Bible. I mean, there are bits of the Bible I don't like. For instance, I'm rather offended by Gideon's Bibles being placed in hotel rooms. I remember I used to. I like the Gospels. They're fine, I think, but a lot of the rest of it is a bit silly.
John's a bit of a funny Gospel, actually, because the thing was, what happened when we started writing the film, we actually went back and actually started researching and reading the Gospels again.
Oh.
And at the outset, we thought, let's do a funny film about the life of Christ. But then, as we started reading the Gospels again and started going into it, we gradually felt that, Christ was, likable, amiable.
Very nice fellow.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really sort of, wasn't a lot of mileage in that. We didn't have any quarrel with Christ.
None at all.
So then we just decided to go in the other direction, just use the period and sort of...
What I felt was a sort of relief about doing the film was that that particular period, 0 to 33 AD, has always been treated in a totally stained glass window fashion.
Mm-hmm.
In Hollywood epics,
lots
people
of choruses of angels.
Talk very, very slowly, yeah. And their teeth are gleaming and their eyes are blue. And it's quite historically inaccurate, and I think that we began to look at it just in historical terms, what happened during that period, what really went on, who was living then, and found that there were all sorts of things, like there's a stoning scene in the Brian movie, in which...
a man who said Jehovah is
yeah,
to the
it's,
stone.
It's stone, but the audience comprises of women wearing beards, trying to look like men. And that is a fact. We found out in our historical research that women were not allowed to go to stonings. I mean, stoning was allowed to go on, that's fine. But women are not allowed to go, you know, which is a strange sort of authority which allow a man to be stoned to death, but not while there are women watching.
Mm. Then who's the guy that wants to be called Loretta? Was it, or have I got the name? Remember?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, that was one of the revolutionaries who. This was rather more about sort of modern revolutionary attitudes.
Yeah.
I think there is a point actually that with the religious reaction in the States here. It's begun to look that the film is just about religion, but I don't think it never was really. It's as much political as religious.
Yeah, it's actually not really about belief in
no,
Jesus
it isn't.
Christ
I will support
or
you
belief in
that.
God. I mean, it's about the sort of flotsam and jetsam of humanity who were around then. And I honestly think that in Brian we portray a more accurate appraisal of what people were like then than you ever get in sort of Hollywood epics or in a lot of sort of treatment of the Bible where you...
What I was saying actually before about the Gospels, I was having a cough now. Can I have another one?
Sure. Yeah, I'm sorry. The only jacket I've got. 3 days.
It is the towel, Mike.
The way a message, for instance, as you read about Christ in the Gospels, soon gets perverted. St. Paul, for instance, changes. I mean, his view of life is quite different to what I imagine a Christian should be from reading the Gospels. And well, we have a sequence in this where Brian unfortunately picks up some followers he doesn't want, and they immediately start to break up into schisms, different factions
that mm-hmm. yeah.
believe that he means something else, you know, which is, I suppose, a part of human nature. We all want to be different.
Can I tell that one?
Yeah, we all want to be in a club, you know?
You mean there's some people who said, take off the shoe, and other
right.
people who said, follow
yeah.
the gourd.
That's right. Yeah.
And I won't translate it so that people will have their appetites.
Yeah.
Let me do commercials, and then can I show your scene where you play Pontius Pilate, which is one of the fun... And let it be said for the record, gang, this is a funny movie. It's hysterically funny. And why people get upset about it is because I think possibly they see it from, as you somebody here said, from their vantage point, rather than from the satirical vantage point. But anyway, let me do commercials. We'll continue after this for the NBC television stations.
The
dust, that scene, didn't
you? I like that.
Back with three of the six men who are Monty Python's flying circus. Set up the little scene that we're about to see you in, Michael. The Pontius Pilate scene.
Well, this is the scene's just after Brian has been arrested for belonging to a revolutionary group. And he's dragged before Pilate, representing the full pomp and might of Rome.
All right. Here's a scene where Brian has just been arrested for being a member of a radical organization. He's brought before Pilate, representing the pomp and might of Rome.
Take one large living area.
Caesar!
Here!
Anyone survivor, sir?
Throw him to the floor!
What, sir?
Throw him to the floor! Now, what is your name, Jew?
Brian, sir.
Brian, eh?
No, Brian.
The little rascal has spirit?
Has what, sir?
Spirit?
Yes, he did, sir.
Hello. Spirits, Bobago, a touch of bearing do.
Oh, about 11, sir.
So, you dare to wade us?
To what, sir?
Strike him, St. Joey, and bury him roughly.
Ah! Oh, and throw him to the floor, sir.
What?
Throw him to the floor again, sir.
Oh, yes, throw him to the floor, please. Now, Jewish rapscallion?
I'm not Jewish, I'm a Roman.
A Roman?
No, Roman.
Now, there might be Jewish people who would take offense at that particular scene. That's what I thought the controversy involved, was the scene we just saw.
I don't particularly see why. I mean, he's
Jewish
calling
rapscallion?
Are you calling him Jewish? Because, he is Jewish.
Yes, but then he's denying it, saying he's a Roman, trying to get off the hook, and, that might
be offensive. Yeah, but his father was actually a Roman, wasn't he?
Yes. Well, he was in the script you guys really wrote.
I mean, I think that is not the point of the scene. He could be an Estonian, a Latvian, an Afghanistani, or a Hindu. It's not the point. The point, actually, of that scene is the absurdity of power, the precariousness of power and panoply and pomp. And it works very well, but if you have a guy who speaks rather strangely, then people are going to start to snigger a bit.
And
which
has
is
a
what
best friend
about.
In Rome named VD, right?
Yes, it's just...
Not giving those initials away.
Maybe if Hitler had a twitch, he might not have done so well.
I mean, we're not saying all Jews are rapscallions. I mean, when my father saw that film, that scene, he was terribly upset because he thought, Brian is obviously Christ in that scene. There's Christ before Pilate. I mean, the only person that was brought before Pilate was Christ, as far as he could see.
What surprises have you had since the picture was released in terms of the reaction you've gotten? Did you expect that what has happened was going to happen?
I don't know. Of course not. I mean, I just...
Helps to sell tickets.
You never know. I mean, I certainly didn't expect to hear people say that this film might be an incitement to violence. I mean, that was a surprise when I heard that.
That's a very silly thing to say as well, I think.
It's a dangerous thing to say. But, I thought it would ruffle a few feathers, but you just, one doesn't know. I mean, I don't know how the religious organizations are organized or set up in the States. I mean, in England, I think we know where we are going to get some criticism from.
Where do you think? Since this show is not seen in the UK, so what's going to happen?
We've already had the censor's office in England has already been inundated with letters and telephone calls from a thing called the Festival of Light, which is a sort of
a self-appointed watchdog committee.
What is censorship
right-wing
like in the UK? What are no-nos there?
Sex is really sort of...
here too, I just wondered if it was the same thing.
It varies. We seem to have more freedom on television than we have here, I suppose, because it's less commercially orientated, but...
Even the commercials overseas have far more freedom than we do in this country. The blue jeans over there, I mean, they're sexy commercials. Here, they're very straight-laced. You go buy a pair of pants and that's the end of it.
I think sex and religion are pretty taboo, and they fused recently in this... A Dane arrived in England.
Excuse me, who arrived?
A Danish
person.
Danish film director wanted to do a film. I don't think he'd even written it, but he wanted to set up a film which was going to deal with the sex life of Jesus Christ. And he was out really fast. Yeah. I mean, the prime minister personally took charge of this case, and the guy was just banned from the country, which is quite extraordinary when you think of what goes on. I mean, the sort of people who ought to be banned from the country.
When you make a movie, is there somebody from the British Office of Censorship on the set while that film was shooting?
No.
Well, how does it work? You send them a print? Or?
Yeah, well, in fact, the Censors Office doesn't, in England, isn't a government organisation. It's actually run by the film industry. And we actually pay the censor to come and censor our film for us. Our production company pays him to come and give us a certificate. And all it does, it's just the film industry protecting its own. In other words, the people who could get caught by a film, if it gets prosecuted, are the exhibitors. Like a cinema can put a film on, somebody could come out and prosecute them for publishing some obscenity or something like that. So if they can say, oh, well, look, it's got the British Board of Film Censors.
That's it,
approval.
It's clean,
that's
right?
A good excuse in court.
Yeah. Yeah. Do they have things like X-rated movies in the United Kingdom?
Yeah, but
like
it's no porn. Yeah. There's no real porn. It's all soft porn, really, on screen.
X, I mean, the alien, for instance, is an X in England.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
That's nothing here. Tame.
I mean, that's a good sort of shocker, really. But that gets an X in England. I'm trying to think of other...
But, I mean, there's a lot of things don't get shown. I mean, Deep Throat didn't really get shown. And
Last Tango in Paris, they cut rather heavily, didn't they, as well?
Yeah.
A lot of censorship.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more. I mean, what is tolerated is sort of...
When you were younger... Did that film come through there, I Am Curious Yellow?
Yeah.
Yes.
Remember the publicity hype on that one? This is the first one where you... And I got, you know, I was taken in. I went to see it. It was a colossal bore.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if that caused a furor over there. Boy, it was
a big furor.
Oh,
they
went crazy.
They tend to, I mean, you know, the people who cause a stir over things like that really tend to concentrate attention on something that would otherwise have actually got through to very few people. It's like a... About 2 years ago in England, the Festival of Light sort of pressure group revived the old law of blasphemy, which hadn't been used since 1921, to get a small publication called Gay News, who had printed a poem about some Jesus's homosexual love for Christ. And they got this law, and it was the case happened, and the law lords in the House of Lords upheld blasphemy in this case, and the editor of the magazine was fined, and I don't think he went to prison, did he?
But
he
he's had a suspended sentence.
But I mean, a tiny little magazine that people would hardly have noticed at all.
Read by what, 25,000, 35,000?
In the gay community, and it's suddenly dragged out, and fingers are pointed, and saying, look at that, you know, sort of evil, disgusting sort of stuff.
What was amazing was the poem was a metaphor, you know. All through history, people had religious love has been a metaphor. The metaphor of sexual love has been used as a metaphor for religious love. And this was just doing exactly that. It wasn't saying Christ was a homosexual. It was.
Why wouldn't you do, you know, you said a spoof of Hitler just in passing 5 minutes ago. That would be a sensational thing for you guys to do, I would think.
Well, it's quite interesting.
Yeah. Not a million miles from what we've been thinking about for the next...
A
next movie. Well, not just Hitler, but...
But that whole Third
War
Reich...
War and all that.
War?
In there. Yes, yes. How people confront each other in wars. I mean, Hitler's been done. Hitler's safe ground up what we've been doing.
I think when we take subjects like, for instance, like the Life of Brian, like let's take biblical days, we're not actually satirizing biblical days or attacking that. We're just using that as a setting for sort of things about people, about the way people react.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at the gallery of characters in this film, they're really like a lot of the characters we've had in the old Python television shows and all that. They're sort of, you know, devious, crafty bunch, you know, always trying to sort of cope with a life that is really very hard on them and very difficult to cope with in their various devious means. And I think that, you know...
When is the Flying Circus coming back?
What, on television?
On television, yeah.
Well, we finished making television shows,
76?
76, yeah. So we haven't done any more since then. It's very difficult for us, because we're a group of six people, to stay together for the kind of time that it requires to make, say, 13 programs.
It's like 13 half-hour programs, like 3.5 feature films, you know.
Yeah.
And you've got to, we have to stick together for a whole year to do that.
And I suppose we like
films. We like the idea of making more films, and we'll concentrate on that probably.
A bit more on films, can't you? I mean, the telly was, we were in a sense,
but the flying
parodying the media.
You know what
all the
a
time.
Hit it was in this country. Mm. I mean, the PBS stations used to run their fundraising drives around Monty Python's Flying Circus. It was unbelievable.
It's shown much more in this country than it was in England. I mean, the repeats, they've shown it in New York 5 or 6 times each series, and in England they've only been repeated twice. Actually,
weren't you in a scrape with ABC where they bought them and they wanted to put them on at 11:30 and you sued to keep them from?
That's right. They bought 6 programs, and they were. The understanding was that these programs would be put out in 2 compilation programs, 3 programs in each back to back. And we were always wary of shows being bought for commercial television in the States because of probable censorship. And the shows were bought on the understanding that there would be no censorship, that they would go out back to back as complete shows. And we saw one of them before it was actually screened and tried to get an injunction against them putting it out because they had really messed up the shows.
What, snipped it apart?
Making nonsense of some
ridiculous
of the
cuts. I think out of the 90 minutes that they'd put together, 22 minutes had been cut for either commercials or for censorship reasons. And it just...
Wasn't that just what they'd cut? It's they'd actually juxtapose things. And there was one sketch I remember which was about this guy coming into the doctor's surgery and he's just got blood pouring out of him. And the doctor sort of is making
sounds funny so far.
Yes. and the doctor's just making him sign forms and things. And there was a little intro bit to this which didn't quite work, did it, the little intro bit? But it didn't matter because we got into the main sketch. They'd cut the sketch, but they'd left this little intro bit in. So, you know, and you've got people sitting at home seeing this, and they, well, that wasn't funny, no.
Left us with egg on her.
And there was another wonderful cut when Graham played a sort of rather old lad sitting there, and he's just turning over certain words in his mouth.
He likes the sound of woody or tinny.
Yes, the sound of words, gorn, caribou, and all that, and his wife sort of sitting there.
Then he got on to intercourse.
That's right, the words get vague sexual connotations, and the wife comes up, and no, intercourse was about the most radically...
explicit, but they cut that at that point as intercourse was about to be said, and suddenly I was over on the other side of the room, drenched.
Because
later on in the sketch,
over.
In fact, the wife had thrown a bucket of water over me to cool me down.
So it looked quite extraordinary. So the cut version looked as though he suddenly
so it wasn't
himself.
That it was just cut for to make room for commercials, but it was cut because
that's the point. Yes, it wasn't just cut for
and this
for
was
commercials.
Going out at quite late at night. I mean, 11:30. We really couldn't understand it. I mean. Give or take a little bit of cutting, we'd have tolerated it, but it was so bad.
Again, it's
that we had
people
to do something.
Approaching something with a expecting to be shocked, expecting something outrageous, and actually looking for things. And
I think that's happened a little bit here as well. Actually.
I think so. Yeah.
Some of the way that, you know, the way some people have commented on the film, the religious groups.
Yeah.
I think they've gone in there anticipating certain things, and that's
well, there are a lot of people. You see, a lot of the in the religious criticism.
Will you stay for a few more minutes? Yeah. I do, but I have to do commercials before you stay. We'll be right back with 3 of the 6 members of Monty Python's Flying Circus, who appear in Monty Python's Life of Brian. After these words from our sponsors, what a mouthful!
Religious groups.
Do you want to finish that on religious groups?
Well, all I was going to say was that I think that from what I've read, that some of the religious groups, the leaders of the religious groups, have not necessarily seen the film but feel obliged to make some statement about it. I mean, they have to, you know, that's a sort of their livelihood.
It's don't you love it when they say evil. Whether it's this picture or it was a television program? Now, I didn't see it, but...
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Right away, the criticism, whatever follows to me, is not valid when they say, well, I didn't see this, but I heard that. What is it like doing television in the UK in terms of the censorship, what they won't let you do?
It's got a lot worse. About 10, 15 years ago, it used to be very good indeed. There was a chap called Hugh Carlton Green who was in charge of BBC, and it was a very freewheeling organisation. Every producer had independence, and just he was responsible for what went on. Our show went on then. Our show wouldn't have started if we'd been trying to start it now.
It wouldn't have then if they'd known it was going to start.
Oh, well.
Yeah, known what it was, they'd have started.
They'd known what was coming.
No, they didn't think it was going to start. It's a political, some sort of political censorship, I think. Like, there's nothing like Saturday Night Live where you can do the president on the Saturday night or whatever, or use topical news. And also there's a certain number of films which have been made about conditions in prisons or even about Northern Ireland, which suddenly don't appear or don't get repeated. And, you know, it's Those sort of areas.
Yeah, it's like Northern Ireland. My brother works in news, and BBC News are not allowed to give any stories about Northern Ireland unless they've come from the Northern Ireland office. Now, the Northern Ireland office is a Protestant office, and so our news is all being vetted really by one side in Northern Ireland.
But also, like the police, recently the Metropolitan Police were trying to get guidelines where they were consulted on every single script involving the police. You know, they would be consulted about where it was going to be shot and how the police were going to be presented. That sort of area, which is something new in the last 10 or 15 years, isn't it? Mm. That sort of control.
But now, when you're going back to Saturday Night Live, you couldn't do something on the Queen. You couldn't spoof that.
Well, we have. I think we did a Python program about the Queen once, which never gets sold again.
They only show that once, didn't they?
Yes.
The other programs they repeated. Significantly, that one was not repeated.
She probably didn't care for it.
And I'm sure she was like,
no, it's called the Royal Show. And we said, at the beginning, we said, well, we understand that the Queen is going to be watching the show tonight, but we're not going to let it make any difference. We're going to carry on as normal. And we had sort of the credits with sort of national anthem and sort of
very ornate Italian script, you know. Credits.
And then we carry on with the show, and every so often there'd be a little ticker tape at the bottom saying, the Queen now watching the Virginian on ITV.
Yeah.
and then the Queen about to turn over. And then suddenly in the middle of the sketch, which we couldn't finish, quite honestly, we suddenly played the national anthem, and everybody sort of stood to attention, and we got the whole audience.
The Dirty Vicar sketch, wasn't it?
Mm. No, it was some terrible tunnel sketch, which I can't remember. Anyway, then this one said, oh, no, she's turned over to ITV again. And I don't know, maybe they didn't like it, I don't know.
I think they were, it's knighthoods they were looking for, really.
Yeah.
That's the problem. You can get knighted there. You can become Sir or an Earl or something, can't you?
You probably
can. You get made an Earl? Would you like to be an Earl? Earl Chapman?
No, it would suit you,
Earl. Yeah. Oh, I think you definitely.
You want to be an Earl?
No, thank you.
Yeah.
You want to be a Lord?
Earl Bostick. Yeah.
No, I think John wants to be a Grand Duke. John Cleese wants to be a Grand Duke. Apart from that, what would you like to be?
What was interesting is
I'd rather be an Archbishop.
Terry'd like to be a Dame of the British Empire, I think.
Does he want to be called Loretta? That's it. Gentlemen, I've got to move on. Thank you all for being here. I really enjoyed seeing your picture this afternoon. And as I said at the beginning of tonight's show, a lot of people with me in the loge, not the balcony, they really liked it, let me tell you. Gentlemen, thank you again. Yeah. Always a pleasure. Michael, good to see you. Graham, nice to have met you. Terry.
Yes.
And Graham, nice to have met you. It gets a little confusing here.
Especially
after a long afternoon in the balcony. We'll continue after these announcements for the NBC television stations.
I thought so. Here's why.
Why, it's Muggs Riley, the bank robber.
Bank robber?
Wrong. He bragged no jail could hold him and tunneled his way out months ago. I believe Peter Parker covered that story.
No. Make fools of us. Make us steal for you.
Hold it! Nobody moves, or the pint-sized web-slinger gets a mask full of hot lead. Get me?
You make us steal!
Spider-Man, save him!
After tangling with a bunch of angry mole men, Muggs is happy to get back in a nice safe cell again.
Amazing.
Farewell, surface people. We return you in your buildings, which will rise to surface again. We'll never steal from surface again.
Mighty glad to hear that, friend.
Where's Spider-Man?
Where is he? Leave already?
I'd like to give him my thanks for saving us.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go, some public domain background music from the Spider-Man cartoon of the late 1960s. And, of course, there you go, 25-minute interview with Michael Palin, Graham Chapman, and Terry Jones on The Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder in 1979. My name is Cliff Nesteroff. You've been listening to Laugh Tracks, a show about comedy on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver and on the internet, the Generation Exploitation Podcast. Thanks for joining us, and I'll talk to you soon.